Hi, I'm Megan Paul. Thank you for joining us on our podcast that recorded the first in a series of female-focused events. This was not the first female-led event CRS has ever had. It was actually a reinvigoration of a successful existing program at CRS. However, we wanted an optimistic lens across this series, so we decided to start off with innovation. We wanted to move our narrative forward and move away from some of the tired rhetoric of the past to embrace an optimism about change and gender parity. Innovation is very much at the centre of legitimately changing the norm. We had a distinguished panel that evening led by our chair, Deborah Gilshan. Deborah's background is in corporate governance, and her pioneering spirit to encourage change, diversity and promoting the female talent pipeline made her the perfect chairwoman for our event. Deborah and our panelists will introduce themselves shortly on the recording, but I just wanted to touch on a couple of things before we got going. Now, it won't be entirely obvious to those listening in, but during that evening, we had no men in the room. And that was actually deliberate because they weren't invited. And actually, we talked about this and decided that we're not going to apologise for that. There are lots of conversations and events where we need a different type of participation. Diversity doesn't seek to amplify one voice at the cost of another, but to encourage all voices to be heard. And I love the phrase that equality is not pie. You don't get less because you give someone else more. However, our event that evening was not about silencing men or about what we might need from them in terms of debate or awareness. It wasn't actually about men at all. That night was about women leading in innovation and about celebrating these women's achievements, recognising each other as innovators and as role models. It was about promoting the value in change and having innovative mindsets. And now, here's our recording of the event.
Thanks, Megan. A real privilege and honour to be invited to be part of this event, the first in your female-led series of events. My name is Deborah Gilshan. I'm the founder of the 100% Club, which is a network for professional women that I founded about 8 years ago. And I have a career in an institutional investment. And I'm also an ambassador for the 30% Club, which is a global initiative to improve diversity, specifically gender diversity, on the boards of public companies that are listed on our stock markets, as well as senior management teams. I was instrumental in building the investor group of the 30% Club and using the transformational power of investor capital to create change in the companies in which, if you have a pension or savings account, you invest in stock markets and you have a voice. And my role for the last 19 years has been holding companies to account on a range of issues related to governance on behalf of the own saver that the financial services market ultimately serves. I set up a network for women about the same time as I got involved in the 30% Club because I noticed a gap in the market, and I thought that there was a need for women in the specific area of my industry to come together and to collaborate and to network. And the idea was to connect female investor professionals with female company representatives, and to create an atmosphere where sometimes in our day jobs we would have adversarial conversations because one thing and want the company to do something else. And I thought it would be good to have another venue where people could get to know each other. So perhaps those difficult conversations might be a slightly bit easier because we knew each other outside of the professional working environment. I started with 50 women. I now have over 600 women on my mailing list. And I have a big event hosted by EY, my colleague here tonight, next month, talking about the role of female directors of public companies. I hope I've been innovative in my career in terms of how I've engaged with the companies that we've that I've been investing in on behalf of end clients. Corporate Governance Network, and they define innovation as an activity that results in a new or meaningful improvement to an existing product, production, or operating process that creates value. And I think in a world of shifting sands and lots of change, we need to be as innovative as possible to find long-term sustainable solution to some of the challenges we all feel and that the world faces as well. So I'll stop there with my introductory remarks. Each of my esteemed panellists are going to talk for a short while about their career and why innovation is important to them. And then we have some other themes that we want to draw out. If you would like to ask questions, I think the way in which the room is set up and the number of attendees we have allows for questions throughout our debate. So please raise your hand and we'll I think we have hopefully a roving mic and we'll get to you. And we'll also take some questions at the end as well. So look forward to the...
Yeah.
I'm really jealous I've not got a Madonna style microphone. Everybody's biogs are in the booklet as well. So we'll start with Carrie. So over to you and tell us about yourself and why innovation is important.
Thank you. I don't know if my Madonna piece is working or whether you can hear me. I'll become extremely loud in a minute. So my name's Carrie Marsh. I'm kind of the entrepreneur and engineer in the room, perhaps, possibly. My background, I started my first company while I was on maternity leave back in 2003 when I was taking video of my little son, and I thought, wouldn't the internet be a really brilliant way to communicate this video to my family in Holland? And so I started, I had previously worked for a network, a streaming video network in 2000, and I thought, I think we should have consumer streaming video. So I came up with a company called Midio, and I went about raising money. I went to business angel groups and venture capitalists, and which is very odd when you've got a baby on your hip and a blonde ponytail and you're going, hey, I'm an engineer and I'm going to build a streaming video company, but so it was tough. But I ended up raising a fair bit of business angel money and other investment for Midio. We ended up integrating with Microsoft and their desktop editing software. We got investment from Best Buy in the US. And so after about 4 years, it was valued at about 1.7 million, which was fantastic. So then YouTube came along, which was fun, wasn't it? Because that was free. But yeah, I launched Midio in 2003. YouTube came out in 2006. So we had to do a bit of a pivot. The consumer video space wasn't working out financially, so we had to pivot into business space. And that worked out fine, and I ended up running that company for another 10 years, until I got itchy feet, which is what entrepreneurs do, and they get a bit samey, gets a bit boring, and I had other ideas. So I then founded my second company called Punchfront Innovation, and I do two things at Punchfront Innovation. I have lots of ideas, and I make them happen, and I help big companies try and think in the same way with the same mindset. So I do consulting. So I've recently just finished a project for the Civil Aviation Authority, where they realise that there's huge amounts of innovation in aerospace at the moment, mostly with air taxis, you know, these vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, which got my sort of physics and engineering mojo going. But mostly they wanted to know in their innovation team how best to engage with startups and how startups think, and how could a regulator really try and work with the startup community, triaging where their innovation team should spend their time. So that's me. Two startups, and I've just finished another Kickstarter campaign for another product, so we can talk about crowdfunding and why women do better in crowdfunding a bit later if you want. But that's me for now. I mean, in terms of innovation, I tend to just live my life in that way. I think it's just doing things better, mm-hmm. and having the nous to realise that the status quo shouldn't be. Yep.
Thank you. Sophie?
I started my education, I did a degree in history at Nottingham University, and my first job was at the Evening Standard magazine, where I started off doing a 2 months work experience. And I remember, it was funny, I remember walking into on my first day, and I remember walking in, and I had, you know, you have these huge questions in front of me. You think, what should I do with my life? I didn't really know, actually, at all. I did Russian history, and I can't remember a single thing at all. And I walked into this room, and at the time, there was a wonderful woman who's my editor called Catherine Osler, and there was a whole group of quite phenomenal women. And I remember walking into that room and started working with them, and I was only meant to be 2 months. And I thought, nothing else makes sense to me outside of this room, but this room of women makes sense to me. And it was incredible. It's incredible women now who, Sasha Slater, who's head of magazines at The Telegraph, it's Cavandra Hodge, it's Kate Ridden, it was, sorry, not Kate Ridden, actually, at that time, she came later. But there was a whole brilliant, brilliant women. And I think I found that very exciting. And I sort of think that if you find something you love and you follow it, then good stuff tends to follow. So I ran with it, and I was very lucky that I ended up staying there for about 8 or 9 years, I think. I started off photocopying, making cups of tea. I did this hilarious thing whenever Catherine, my editor, or my deputy editor asked me a question, conveniently my back was to them in front of my computer, so I usually didn't actually know the answer to what they were asking. But I frantically Googled and had this really clever way of going, oh, do you mean that? Yes, hang on, isn't it the? Google and get the answer. And I ended up, so I had a brilliant time with them, and then Catherine Oster went to Tatler magazine. And she took me with her, and I ended up staying at Tatler and Condé Nast for another sort of 9 years. And it was interesting, when I first went to Condé Nast, people asked me, said, was it very different from a weekly, because it's a jump from a weekly to a monthly, and I sort of naively in the beginning said, oh, no, it's all, you know, da-da-da, and then I realised later how profoundly different it was. And I think my point with innovation is change, and it's the zeitgeist. Tina Brown talks about it, Nicholas Coleridge talks about it, just they've both written their books recently, and it's all about that sort of nuance of when to leave a party, I think. And for me, that's changed, and that's all different for everyone in this room. I mean, you know, when you stop learning, I think, or when you feel bored of something, or there's a repetition to it, I think it's time to make that change. And actually, I've had a sort of very solid career. I only had 2 jobs. And I think that for me, at the beginning of this year, I left Condé Nast. It was a huge decision. It was sort of that thing of when you're breaking up with a boyfriend and you weigh up the pros and the cons and you go, oh, God, but he's really untidy, but then he's kind to animals. And then on the other hand, you go, oh, but I work with these lovely people and I'm scared or something. And the funny thing was, I sort of ended up, I think the best decisions in life are made when they sort of are made. I know that sounds odd. I don't know if any of you have found yourself in that position, but apparently it's called voting with your feet, where you find yourself leaving a situation, not because, I mean, I don't do it. Have you had this sort of clever plan in your brain and you do it in this very artful manner? I didn't. I just realized that life was moving really fast, and I didn't know for me how quickly a glossy monthly was keeping up with that. And I knew I'd been doing something for a long time, and I knew I wanted to start doing something different. And I think we all communicate in different ways. You know, I think we're in a really exciting time in our culture where, as you can all see here now, we're all talking so much. We're expressing how we feel. And things are just fast, fast paced, I think. And so I ended up basically just going freelance and then setting up a company and working on a project basis and also consistently with different brands. So I contribute to different publications, and I also work strategic consulting with brands and do a lot of events and writing. So I kind of can put everything I love doing in one glorious sort of pot, and it works. And I think that exactly. I mean, I haven't used the word innovation a lot, but I think innovation is changing something, even if it scares you, and it's doing something differently, and it's moving. It's moving with the world around you and what that's dictating you to do. I remember when I read Tina Brown's book, she talked about why Tatler was so unbelievably successful in the 80s, because Princess Diana was there and Thatcher was in power. And that period, that magic period, sort of lasted this amount of time, when she knew when she had to go, when it was time to move on. And I think great people do that. It's no disrespect to the past, but you've got to look to the present and I think and to the future. And I think I'm a really firm believer in there's no need to be rude about what was to create what is. You just go And I feel very lucky to have been in a profession that has enabled me to do that so seamlessly. And I've got to stop talking because you've got to go.
I think there's a theme that we can draw out later about the choices we make, and that the corporate world, or what big business looks like, actually is not fitting in with what a lot of people want to do with their lives now, and the sort of world they want to live in, and the sort of working patterns they want to have, and the lives that they want to have as well. And I think, I'm not sure whether there's any statistics about more women leaving organisations to go on their own than men, but I think it's an interesting phenomena that we can explore. Nick.
Hello everyone, I'm Nick Govier. My professional career started when I was 6 years old, and I borrowed my mum's heels and set of pearls and got a box, and I wrote VIB on it, which was my very important briefcase. I was set up, ready to go. And I think I always knew from a really young age I wanted to control my own destiny and follow my dreams and let the crazy ideas that existed in my head happen. And I started working in PR straight from university at the age of 21, which was perfect for a kind of dyslexic, creative, slightly outsider insider, in terms of it being an environment that I could be creative and expressive. But very quickly it became apparent to me that I needed to control my own destiny, and I set up my first company when I was 29, a company called Unity, which became quite a big deal in our world, and ended up winning tons of awards around the world and working with people like Marks and Spencer's and Direct Line and Facebook, etc. I then did this really weird thing about walked away from my own company, partly for the reasons you've talked about, when suddenly I turned around and this thing I'd created and loved and was my firstborn came along before my kids, became a cage, and it was like, this isn't what it's about. And I wanted to rip everything down and start again, so I did that. It was one of the hardest decisions I ever made, and it was a bit more complicated than that, but legally there's only so much I can say. But on the process, I'd become a natural innovator and had backloads of businesses, and I'm an investor here. I was one of the early investors in Albright. Set up Blurred at the tail end of 2018 in October. But innovation's always been at the core of everything for me. So when I set up Unity when I was 29, I accidentally set up a consumer PR agency, having always done corporate and B2B work. It just kind of happened organically. I ended up being given a brief by a friend in a completely different territory to the one that I'd trained in, and I'd got to a board level in my previous kind of role, and actually the fact that I had no idea about what I was doing, it was the secret to our success, because it was 2005, there's some themes here, 2004 Facebook was born, so everyone else who did consumer PR did it the way they'd always done it, and I applied kind of solid comms board level thinking, but to an entirely new and emerging world. And it was like, so everyone else was still doing things the way they'd always been done, because I didn't know how to do it. I went, what does this new world present? What are the opportunities? And that created this DNA at the heart of that company that for 12 years was known for breaking every kind of mold. And for me, it was so hard to walk away from my own company and the people and its reputation and what I built. And honestly, I went to an event like this about a month after, and I was like, hi, I'm Nick from, where am I from? Who am I? I don't even know what I'm doing. But it was just the most brilliant thing to start again, fresh. And it's just a joy for me with my company that I look around and any minute I'm like, what can we do today that we couldn't do yesterday? You know, that's so exciting to me, because the world is moving at such a phenomenal pace. And that's where the excitement lies for me. It's not in doing the same old stuff over and over. It's about kind of grasping the opportunity that the new world and new innovation presents. And that's my lifeblood. And that's why I'm a serial entrepreneur. Like I said, it's not even just these two companies. I've been a kind of major shareholder in others. I invest in loads of things because it excites me. And because I see the opportunity, I want to be part of that and part of those stories. So that's my little bit of background.
And that's a great segue into one of the areas that we wanted to discuss was the focus on solutions. So Carrie and I had a prep call last week in preparation for this, and one of the things that really came out from what you were talking about, Carrie, was the need for solutions and the focus on solutions, and that's often what drives innovation and innovative problem solving. So, and given your background in engineering,
yeah.
which is a very traditionally male-dominated industry, I think when you look at something like the gender pay gap as some, proxy for sectors and how they embrace women, I think construction and engineering's just about as bad as financial services.
Sadly, yeah. I mean, when I was at university, I also went to Nottingham. We've just found out we went to the same university.
And I was Leicester, so I was just down the road.
Right.
Midlands.
On my course, there was 100. I did manufacturing engineering because I really wanted to know how to make things or how things worked and how you made them. And there were 5 girls out of maybe 6 or 7 out of about 100, 110. And I'd really lovely to be sitting here today, 25 years later, having just gone back to Nottingham and had a 25-year reunion, and say that that's no longer the case, but it still is, sadly. I mean, perhaps there'll be 20 on that course now, but we've made nothing like the progress that we need to make. But in terms of a need, yeah, it's always a need. I wanted to send video of my son to my family in Holland. But if you want an example of what I've done recently, which is a really practical need, was my first Kickstarter campaign. I've just finished my second one.
Explain to people who don't know, because I didn't know what Kickstarter is.
Okay, so crowdfunding, there's lots of different ways you can do crowdfunding, okay? You can go to a crowd of people and ask them to invest in your company, and they all own a little piece of your company, and if you're successful, they will be a little bit successful. There's crowdfunding like Funding Circle that you see all over the telly at the moment, where basically anybody that wants to make more money out of their money can loan to small businesses at really high rates because small businesses are prepared to pay high rates. And, so that's where you loan money to a business and you'll get maybe 9% back interest. So it's better than putting your money into a bank account, yeah? And then there's something called Kickstarter is actually pre-sales, which is why I've always used Kickstarter. So Kickstarter is where you basically work out how much it's going to cost you to make something, a product, a game, a thing, and you say, this is how much money I need to make it happen. Who wants to buy it? And everyone, you make a video and everyone goes, I want one of those. And if enough people go, yeah, I want one of those, and they say, I'll buy one, you hit your target, it happens. All their credit cards get debited, you go away and you make it. But crucially, if you don't hit your target, it's all off. No one gets charged. So you have to be really, really careful. So I did a Kickstarter campaign because I've got 3 boys, and I found that when they got off the rugby pitch or the football pitch, the mud on their boots weighed more than the £100 boots that I'd bought them, and I couldn't get it off, and I was using my fingernails. And so I came up with a product called the Boot Claw. I don't know if any of you have got kids, whether you know it, but you've got one.
No, I've seen it on Facebook.
You've seen it on...
Oh,
you need to buy it.
Yeah. So I said, this is ridiculous. I need a product that will solve this out. Hey, I did engineering. I know about injection molding plastics. Yay, let's make this happen. So I costed out how much it cost to buy the tooling to injection mold a boot claw, and I did the Kickstarter campaign, raised £30,000, got the machinery. Now I have a manufacturing unit in the Midlands. And we're a bestseller on Amazon, and we're in Sports Direct. And that took about 3 years. But that was a need, because obviously I just got so annoyed with the mud. And it's so exciting, just actually coming up with something physically tangible that you can say, well, we worked this out. And the interesting thing conversation we had was, women do much better at fundraising in crowdfunding scenarios than in any other, so in business angel, VC. So, and the reason I think that that's the case is that men are much more risky with their plans. So when I was fundraising for my first company, Midio, I went and met some venture capitalists, and I gave them my business plan, and they said, this is great. Can you go and put some more zeros on the end of that? You know, we want really big return. I mean, and I'm like, well, that's what I believe I can execute. And then venture capitalists spread their risk, but they need to know that any one of those 20 that they're investing in, you know, they know not 70% of them are going to fail, 2 of them are going to break even, but one of them will go absolutely crazy. And so everyone they invest in needs to have the potential to go berserk. And I wasn't prepared to give the venture capitalists a business plan that would have involved a huge amount of luck and risk. But with crowdfunding, it's different because a lot more men do crowdfunding campaigns, but of the successful crowdfunding campaigns, women do better. So they just are more realistic with their planning, and I think, this is my opinion, plus also there's a much more sort of ground level playing field in terms of the backers. So you've got men and women all backing, whereas if you go and you go to business angel networks, I pitched to a room full of 100 high net worth men, maybe a few women in there. Same with VC, there's not enough women there. So they are backing what they relate to, what they empathize with, who they see themselves in. Whereas crowdfunding, much more level playing field gender-wise. So what you find is lots more men do crowdfunding campaigns, but lots more women are successful at crowdfunding campaigns. And that's really encouraging, I think.
Yeah. It's fascinating having... I work with an institutional investment, and this is why, you know, the lack of gender balance in financial services matters, right? Because we are, you know, women as portfolio managers, women as investors, and women as investors in, you know, as a saver and as if you have a pension as well. I think statistics from the UK, I think British Banking Association says something like 1% of venture capital funding in the UK goes to female entrepreneurs. And it's back to that theme as well of, I mean, the myth that women don't take risks. I think women want to understand more about the risks that they're taking on. But also the piece around women being appointed or being funded on what they've done rather than men being appointed on their potential. And I think all these themes are very... they're all based on the same types of stereotypes or biases that are inherent in the system. The Alison Rose review of female entrepreneurship. So Alison Rose is now the new CEO of RBS, one of, I think, only 5 or 6 female CEOs we have in our top 350 companies listed on the UK stock market. So her review into female entrepreneurship found that we could add up to 250 billion of new value to the UK economy if women started and scaled new businesses at the same rate as UK men. And I think what's apparent and clear is that there are ideas and solutions and innovative solutions for women, but they're not getting funded. And I think that's a kind of a problem in the system as well that needs to be called out and addressed.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, sure.
It's a comedy story based on Albright we're in. So this is the second club in the UK. They've got one in Rathbone, they've launched in LA, they've got New York and Washington coming. And it started initially as a, it's evolved with time, but as a kind of funding platform. And so it was founded by Anna Jones, who was the chief exec of Hearst, and Debbie Wasco, who was an OBE, you know, sold her last business for 40 million, and that was her second business. Incredibly successful and accomplished women. And I remember them telling me that when they were looking for funding for Here, the first question they were asked is, what do your husbands do? I mean, and this is the thing, it's not that women actually don't have the confidence to go out on their own. Yeah. It is... your point that if so many of the men who are the key to unlocking a lot of that funding aren't interested and are going to say, I mean, Martha Lane Fox, you know, she was asked, well, when are you having a baby? That's what, you know, I think everyone knows that story, but it's just like ludicrous. Even when people have like an exemplary CV and career, the fact that's still the point, and the comedy being it, that it'd be about investment for women and they were asking them that, it's just...
And how interesting.
Incredible.
Martha Lane Fox was one of the, if I remember rightly, the first female directors of Marks and Spencer's. So for a long time, many of our boards have been all male, right?
Yeah.
And when you think about one of the biggest selling parts of Marks and Spencer's portfolio is bras and underwear, it probably would have been a good idea for them to have got some women on their boards a little bit earlier. It's fascinating having done a lot of work with corporate boards, the risks and opportunities that boards and management teams miss because they don't look at things from a different perspective. I had a letter published in the Financial Times in September calling out the all-male board at WeWork. You may have heard of WeWork and the fact that they failed their initial public offering, so trying to get onto the stock market and get funding from public shareholders. And there was lots of discussion about what had gone wrong at WeWork, including their founder, CEO, and debt that they didn't know they had, and or it got disclosed in the IPO circular. But there was not much coverage of the fact that until about, I think, a couple of days before the IPO, they had an all-male board. And, you know, what questions would a more diverse board perhaps have asked? And I think it's really interesting that these things are beginning to unravel in the system, because what we did do in the past and the way that we did it isn't fit for now, and it might not have even been fit for then. But Sophie, you, when we were talking earlier, you were saying that you've worked in an industry that's had quite a lot of female leadership, and so maybe you could talk a little bit about that influence. You've touched on it earlier, but this isn't about bashing male leaders, but I think we do have to recognise the opportunity we're missing about not harnessing 50% of the population. So perhaps you could provide your reflections.
I mean, I've been very fortunate to have worked with incredible women for my entire career, actually, particularly at the Evening Standard magazine. And I suppose that's probably quite rare. I mean, at Condé Nast, it was sort of a running joke, I think, that it was just almost an entirely female workforce. I think Nicholas Colwood used to joke that he sort of panicked about when everyone was going on maternity leave because there were no men, you know. Whereas I think it was a high percentage of men in the top jobs, and there was a huge pay gap with that. So I think it comes into... Personally, my mentors, I mean, I think this was something that we touched upon briefly, which is this concept of mentors and mentorship, and the fact that my mentors have actually been women who are such champions of that, and have really, I think I've been very spoiled actually in that respect, that I had women who thought that anything was possible, I think, and made me feel so. I mean, I don't think you can't underestimate for me anyway, personally and professionally, the impact my career has had on my life and how empowering it is and how rich it's been. And I think with the women that I've been spoilt with, that they perhaps hadn't had the career that I'd had, and had come up with obstacles from men. So I think they were very conscious that they wanted to give us that support system. Yeah. I've always felt that professionally I was a safe space, for want of a better way of putting it, that we all talked very openly about our lives, and so I felt very privileged in that respect. But I think, you know, regardless of, I mean, diversity is just perspective, isn't it? So for me, diversity is not being male or female, it's everything. You know, now I'm pretty conscious about trying to ask everyone's opinion, from my father to a girl who's working with me who might be 22, to just whoever it is, just ask whoever you meet what they think, to, you know, friends of mine Megan, who's in always a completely different career. Yeah. You just got to, because we're all responding to information around us and we're all part of this world, and actually diversity is important, not because we're trying to be politically correct, but because that is the glorious nature of this world, that it's a result of so many stimulus and so many types of people. And actually, we could be two women, but we'd have completely different perspectives on things. It could be two men, you know, I could confront everyone in the room with an image and we'd all maybe have different takeaways from it based on our history. So, yes, I'm lucky that I've never felt that I haven't been able to achieve anything because I'm a woman. But I think within that, I think we have to be we have to expand the conversation, I think, about diversity, and to make sure that everyone is being heard. And I think that's the nicest thing that's going on in culture now, is that we are, everyone, you know, has much more of a voice, really.
I mean, I think the real aim of diversity is cognitive diversity, and people will know this. I've done a lot of work, as I said, with corporate boards, and have looked a lot at academic research and research that says companies perform better. There's no evidence that homogenous boards make companies perform better, so I'm not sure why we have to prove that adding more diversity will lead to corporate outperformance, but that's been a lot of the focus. I apologise for people who have heard this before, but I did maths at university, so I love equations. And there's a brilliant political economist in the US called Scott E. Page, who has come up with a mathematical equation on diversity. And put simply, he says that the diversity bonus is 1 + 1 can equal 3 if the two ones are different. And that's how I think about when I look at homogenous teams and homogenous boards. And if we want innovative solutions, then cognitive diversity and different experiences and different backgrounds are so key. And I think that's why, for me, cognitive diversity is one of the biggest missed opportunities within organisations, big or small, because people do think about it as political correctness rather than actually best optimal ideas and how teams work, and that the most effective teams are the ones that can disagree and challenge each other.
I mean, I think the sort of ultimate aim, isn't it? I often feel that I'd like it for people to, the way they think and what they represent and how they process stuff comes first, and then you get the man, woman, black, white, blah, blah afterwards. I often feel that the sort of the rest comes first, and I think I'm sure they're fabulous because they're, you know, whatever, they're a woman and they've overcome, you know, whatever it is, but actually, you know, it would be great for us all not to say he's black and he's this and he's that and he's done this, or you're a woman and you've done this. It's just that those achievements come first.
Deborah Meaden from the Dragon's Den has a brilliant quote that says she doesn't say she's a woman in business, she just says she's in business.
Yeah.
Right, so don't distinguish.
Well, I hope so, because I think that's the ultimate aim, isn't it? But I think it's not like anything, you have that period before you get there, when everything has to be very pronounced and deliberate in order to elicit that change. But
I just think cognitive diversity, obviously, you know, 1 + 1 making 3, things can be better, but also I think the lack of cognitive diversity is such a fundamental risk to your business. I mean, 2008 happened because everybody thought the same, and everybody perpetuated the same thinking over and over again till the resonance just caused it to explode. If you've got a team and one person in that team on a massive boat or a massive rowboat goes and looks over, peers over, leans over the edge, you'll be fine. But if everybody on that boat goes and leans over the edge at the same time, it's going to tip over. So, you know, that's what happened in 2008.
We still miss what's right in front of us, right? We still, the world still misses what's blindingly obvious to them.
But I think also linking this to innovation, it comes from constraint often.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said, I'm dyslexic. It is my superpower, because when everyone's looking over there,
you're doing that.
I'm looking over there. So yes, to your point, it's every type of person. You know, would actively hire someone with autism. Look at Greta Thunberg. She's managed to land a message pretty effectively with this, you know, so-called disability. But I think innovation comes from constraint. And, you know, we were talking about this. I've got enormous pressures. I've got, you know, within a year, my business now works for Coca-Cola, Marriott International, BT Group, LVMH. It's like I'm running a big business already. I've got 2 children. I commute. I'm very time poor, yet there's so much opportunity. And I think it's very easy to look at things and think these are all excuses or reasons why I can't innovate or be creative, when actually that constraint is what can force that out of you. And my ex-business partner used to say, whatever brief, you know, we get, it's the best brief we've ever seen. you know, which was a really good point. Whatever you're trying to solve or whatever you're trying to apply some innovation to, this is the best opportunity you're going to get. And if there are like 17 barriers, brilliant. You know, it's tightening it. It's the blue sky that often kind of frightens us. So I think it is diversity of thought. It's about bravery. I mean, I'm a big believer in you've got to have guts and you've got to be brave. But it doesn't mean you're foolhardy. I talk to my board about this all the time. I'm like, we have to be brave if we're going to stay ahead. But we have to choose our bets and place our bets carefully. You know, manage that risk to make sure, you know, we mitigate that risk where possible. But if you never take that leap, if you never attempt to see that constraint as an opportunity, you'll never do it, because there is never going to be an opportunity for an idea or a thought or anything where it's perfect and the carpet is rolled out for you.
Can I ask a selfish question?
Sure.
So obviously in law, we're very traditional, and we're sort of almost fighting between the traditional safe environment that we know we've come from. I'm not saying that's wrong.
Yeah.
On Sophie's point, kind of slack off what's gone before, and we've only had 100 years of women in law, which we celebrated this year in any event, so
amazing.
But then you're looking at being brave and courageous and the excitement that's over there, you're like, well, is that too exciting for us, because I'm in law and I need to stay safe, and you know, I can't put things in the cloud, for example, because you know, my private wealth clients will freak out that I've just done something as dramatic as that with their information. And you know, even something as what we think is really simple, like putting your information in the cloud, can be, in our environment, remarkable. So how do you, like, looking at constraints and looking at different ways of innovating around that, how do you marry what is good about tradition and important about some of the things that we stand for and regulation, particularly in the financial sector as well? How do you marry that with where you want to go?
So the safe ground is where we are now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think you have to worry about where you are now, because we know where we are now. The harder thing to do is to put yourself in the place in the future. So I'm oversharing slightly, but you know, I reached a point with my company Unity where publicly, you know, it couldn't have looked better, but privately it was a problem and I had an issue with my business partner. And I ended up, and I'd never told anyone, I didn't even talk to my husband about it. It was too big a thing. Too big a thing to face, that this business I'd spent 12 years growing was now making me unhappy. And then I told a friend who was a coach, and I opened Pandora's box this tiny little bit, and then it exploded open and it was never going to go back in the box again. And she said this really interesting thing to me, and she said, often when people have affairs, people say that's what leads to the divorce. You know, they've had an affair, marriage is over. She was like, actually, the marriage is over. The affair is just that testing of the future, going, will anyone ever find me attractive again? Could I have a life beyond this? So she was like, you need to have an affair. I was like, crikey, this is exciting. So what she meant was professionally. So she was like, and then I was like, oh, darn it, I'm already on marriage number two. It could have been marriage number three. But she planted the seed, and she was like, you know what now is. You know what now is in the legal world. What you need to do is open your mind to what then could be. So she was like, I want you to have that affair of you're no longer with your company. You know, you have a blank sheet of paper. You can build whatever you want. And I went away, and I wrote the word blurred, and I wrote this proposition, bashed it out, you know, didn't spend a lot of time doing it. But that was enough. For me, I was like, there is a future for me. This is what I could create and what I could build. But the point is, it's the easy bit is understanding where you are now. The hard bit is being open to the future. So have affairs, ladies. Yeah. That's the way to do it. And you know, take, it doesn't have to be long. I didn't labour over it. But I was like, okay, now I get that can be my future. And because I'd done it before, I knew I could do it again. So it was easier because I'd invested in other things and I'd built my own businesses. But that notion of it is achievable. And your world is more complex than most because it is so grounded in regulation. But there are always ways. And I totally broke the mold with both of my companies. I've totally broken the mold for how things should be done. You know, I can't bear that people think of PR as vacuous and shallow, and you know, that is so far from what I do. I do kind of governance, you know, sustainability for Coke, you know, dealing with ocean waste, big stuff. There are ways of marrying the two, but you've got to envisage the future or you'll never open your mind to that innovation that will get you there.
I actually did that. Well, now that you're saying that, I realise that's exactly the affair, the business affair.
Yeah.
Because while I was running Midio and we'd pivoted to business-to-business streaming video, which wasn't as exciting about what I built, and I was getting a bit... And so I was registering Punchfront Innovation, a company... You know, I was built buying the domains. I was thinking about the product. I was researching whether there was anything out there that like a boot claw, which there wasn't. And it wasn't until I realised, ooh, this is really exciting.
You let it in.
This is
you
where
let
I
it
want,
in, didn't you?
I let it in, that I decided, okay, you know, I want to be here. I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do.
I think we're all governed. You know, you might be law, you might be an engineer, you know, consultant, fashion. We're all governed by the same principles as human beings, and we don't love change. That's the thing. A lot of people don't change because it's easier to stay the same. And a lot of people don't change when they don't know what the other side's going to look like. And I think when I decided to leave magazines, I had no idea what the other side was going to look like. But I knew I couldn't stay where I was. I knew even if I wanted to, I knew I couldn't, because I just found myself making this change. And I've done it personally again with a relationship. Again, when I ended a relationship, and I had no, you know, I didn't have someone waiting in the wings to get down on one knee, and I wasn't going to live happily ever after. I had absolutely no idea what this was going to look like. But I knew I couldn't stay there. And I think sometimes you almost make like a sort of backwards decision, because you change not because you know it's going to be brilliant, but just because change is what keeps us alive as humans, and that is regardless of what you do every day when you get up in the morning. I think that's what's so important about having such a diverse panel this evening, is that break us all down, and actually we're all fighting the same we're all fighting the same things, you know, everyone, as a woman, as a man, you know, we've all got what we're trying to achieve. And I think change is very, very scary, and it's easier not to, actually. But I in my life have been blown away by what happens when you actually do change, and the people that help you along the way that you never realized, who really show this kind of, and you find yourself turning to different avenues. And I think I remember, I'll make this very quick because I have a tendency to talk a lot, but I remember when I first started at Tatler, I was absolutely petrified and I didn't really know what I was doing. And I was sitting in the editorial department. I was actually meant to be working in the fashion department, and I had never done any styling. And my boss, the fashion director at the time was ill, and someone clocked on that I was quite good with people, so came in and said, "Sophie, you're going on this shoot." And I said, "Okay, right, what am I doing?" And they were like, "You're styling the Queen's party planner. You need to get her to hold some balloons and dress her. Oh, and she's quite cross and she's 60. So I said, "Okay." But I said, you know what, there was a real moment. I could have actually have said no. And I came quite close to saying no, because I thought I'd rather not absolutely balls this up. But I'm just going to say yes. So I'm just going to say yes. And I went and I arrived. It's one of the most my favourite moments in my job. And I arrived, couldn't find her. She was upstairs. Her wig had fallen off. She was livid. She hadn't slept the entire night because she was so nervous about this shoot. She was surrounded. She was screaming at this makeup artist. She was really cross with her. And I walked in and I thought, oh God. And our editor at the time was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful woman called Kate Reardon, who has been a big influence in my life. It's this amazing woman. And I thought, God, if I go back and I don't get a good picture, I think I'm actually going to be fired. So I thought, okay, right. And we spent the day together. And by the end of the day, we were having the best time. We were both, I bought all this vintage Balenciaga, so she literally thought I was some kind of goddess. It was a complete accident, actually, how I managed to get this stuff, but it was there. So we were dressing up, we were throwing balloons around, and we got this incredible image, which I've actually got to find. Kate was absolutely thrilled, and she was quite specific. She was really sort of thrilled with stuff, so she was really thrilled with this. But most importantly, I walked away from that situation, and I thought, I did that. I made her potentially quite terrible day into a really, really, really great day. And, you know, that was sort of, because I said yes to something I didn't really know if I was going to be good at it. I had no idea. I hadn't studied Balenciaga since the age of two. All I knew is that I wanted to make people happy, and I wanted her to have a good day, and I wanted a beautiful image, and I wanted that to work. And that wasn't part of some kind of genius plan. That was just kind of, I think there's a moment in life, many moments in life, I'm sure you've had them and you will continue to have them, where I sort of describe it as you just sort of shut your eyes and...
Yeah, you have to be brave.
You just go for it.
Can I build on that?
I just wanted to say, I like the word brave, but I also like the word bold. And I think, but you talked about having a business fair. I like the term side hustle. Yeah, so the 100% club for me was my side hustle whilst I had a full-time corporate role. Yeah. And actually, as I've pivoted away from a full-time corporate role, it's kind of come into its own for me as well.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people, and I don't know whether this is a gender skew bias, whether more women do this than men, but that are doing so many other things outside of their full-time day job, as well as being, you know, mums or daughters or sisters or whatever else. But
and with mine, it had
and
to
I
be.
And I want to ask some get some questions.
It had to be an affair rather than a side hustle, because I actually had to close one to do another one. Yeah. But Indian Knight, this was from a book I read about 12 years ago. She just had this quote in it that, "What would Madonna do?" And seeing we're channeling Madonna today, but I channeled that. It was a bit like, you can be you, the flawed human being that you're trying to project is better than you really are. But what would Madonna do? And Madonna would be like, fuck it, I'm going to do that interview. I'm going to put myself in that difficult position. You know, I'm going to do something that might make me look like a tit to my school friends, you know, but to the people that don't know who I am, they're going to think that's impressive. And I still channel that to this day.
You know, that's such an important point, not wanting to look like a tit. Well, I mean, that's why a lot of people don't
do
start
it. But it's like, what would Madonna do?
We don't want to fail.
I think someone's written a book called "What Would the Spice Girls Do?"
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same concept, and I channel it all the time. And if I'm, of course, called by the BBC to go live on air within half an hour about a programme I hadn't seen, I'm like, Google's my friend. You know, what would Madonna do? Either I can shirk away, or I know that I can do it, and I channel that, because otherwise you won't come out of the cave. You won't invent fire. You know, this is human progression on the most basic level. It is only when people started to believe they could do something else that we evolved as human beings to the people we are today. So it is natural, but it doesn't mean it's not painful, if that makes sense. Doesn't mean it's not difficult.
I had a real wobble before my first Kickstarter campaign, and I remember being with my friend Jane in the gym and saying to her, I really want to do this, I just don't know if I'm brave enough. I mean, what if I put myself out there? And because on Kickstarter, you have to do 2-camera video, you know, my name's Carrie, and I've got a really good new product, and blah, blah, blah. And I said to her, I don't know if I'm brave enough to put myself out there. What if I'm... She went, "Who are you, and what have you done with Carrie?" You know, I mean, of course you're going to do this. I went, shit, you're right. I've got to do it.
But it's that imposter syndrome.
Sorry, I want to try and get some questions from the audience, and then we can go back, because I want to talk about women's networks as well. So then we'll come back to imposter syndrome. Any questions from the audience at this stage? Yeah.
It's been amazing to sort of hear from you and sort of being able to respond to positive mental attitude and grasping carpe diem and all that. That is great, and I think that there's a lot that people can relate to. However, there is that, I can harness that and do it, but practical life sometimes comes in the way. How did you deal with, whilst you're doing a side hustle, having your affairs, managing the practical element of life and the challenges that that can bring?
I've done all this whilst having a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old and having 6 miscarriages along the way. Again, I think it's better to overshare in these situations, because it's so easy to look at people who are on a platform who've been chosen because they've succeeded. I think it's really important to share that isn't actually always the case, and there's stuff that goes on in all of our lives. I think it depends who you are, and I had to work out what made me happy, and what makes me happy is to move and feel alive and to... you know, move with that zeitgeist and to tap into that. And actually it was, you know, I don't know if there are any links, but it's each time I freed myself up, you know, that's how I ended up having children, because I stopped living in a, in whatever cage I was in at that time. So it's incredibly personal, I think, to each person. But that's what I was getting at when I said about constraint leads to creativity in one's life. Is often it's, I find, the tighter the cage, the more my desire to break it down and do something different with life. And it's, if you just look at the barriers, all you will ever see are the barriers. And that was my point of, you know, you got to look beyond and see what's there. And then every other barrier, you can take them one by one and find the way to knock them down. But if you don't believe in where you're going, or you don't believe that thing is possible, you wouldn't even start to knock them down.
But I think also different things make different people feel safe. And I think you have to work out, and when I say safe, I mean makes you feel comfortable in a way that you can achieve your full capacity. And I think that you, what I had to work out in my life is what around me made me feel safe and protected and in control. I think, you know, control's a big word. And for you, it might be, I don't know, writing a list that you keep by your bed so you know, and ticking stuff off, or whatever it is. There'll be stuff you can do on a day-to-day basis. Mine was surrounding myself by, I'm very privileged that I have incredible friends and incredible people that I've, through Condé Nast, that's the richest thing they've ever done, is given me this amazing women that I, you know, I'm still very close with. And I think I'm a huge oversharer as well. And I don't stop talking a lot of the time, because there was a time in my life when I wasn't as happy and I didn't talk about anything. I kept everything inside, and it was a bit of a disaster. So by default, Kate Ridden, my editor, always said that to me as well. She was like, the reason why, because I sleep very well now, you know, all this sort of stuff. Like she said, the reason you sleep so heavily all the time is because you're so busy processing all day to us. About everything. So I was in a car with her going to these fashion shows all the time, and she'd just be with me in a car, and I think I was just da 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 da. And I think for me, that's how I achieve the most. And that might be very different from someone else, because someone else might not want to talk about what they're feeling every second of the day. That might make them feel in control, because I know a lot of people that are like this, and that's how they achieve what they do, because they are, you know, no one will see their feet battling with the water, and that's their version of it. So there's no wrong or right, I think, for this, whatever we call success. And believe me, every single person who you deem successful has internal battles, whatever that is, in a myriad of different ways. It's that thing of be kind, because you don't know what's going on. And I promise you, we all do, everyone does. And have to figure out your way through it.
And I think the importance of role models as well, and kind of the role models we get. Do you want to add anything, carry on?
Well, just on that work-life balance thing, yeah. I mean, it was really, really hard at the beginning. I mean, the biggest challenge that I faced, I was raising money from the Business Angel Network, and I had literally a term sheet come to me, and I couldn't look at it because my second son, Jono, who I'd had 6 weeks before, because now the first one's old enough and he's toddling around, and you know, his temperature wouldn't go away, and he had this huge swelling on the top of his head like half a tennis ball, which basically is what happens when you have meningitis. And he had pneumonococcal meningitis, and I had to leave the term sheet, which was for £500,000, and just drop everything and go to the hospital, and we didn't know for a week if he was going to live or die. So you just get through, and you just compartmentalise and prioritise. And this term sheet's going to be there when you get back, and you just work it through.
I think we should have another session on compartmentalisation, because like that's so key as well. There's a question behind on that side. Yep.
Yes, sorry. I like the analogy. As a divorce lawyer, I love the analogies. But I think we all do actually learn from making and breaking relationships. I think some people can only see the negative in it. It's an ending and it's failure. And others see it very much as a new start, an opportunity. My question was, older women, because there are some of us here who are a generation older than you. No, we're generation. We've got children your age. Seriously, have we been a barrier? Because if we have, you need to tell us that. Because that's the perception, is that we didn't manage to do the change, and we would not want to be the barrier for you. We would want to be the enablers.
I think this is a really important area that doesn't get enough airtime about. So we were going to talk about women who support other women and the importance of women supporting other women, but I think some of the most horrible times I've had in my career was when other women haven't helped me.
Yeah.
And for some reason it's impacted me much more than if it's been a man. And I think these are really difficult conversations to have, but I think if we want long-term solutions, we actually have to be brave and willing to have the conversation, because I've also sat in many discussions where the reason why women aren't more senior in certain industries is because they all go and have children. Like, there's just this massive assumption that every woman goes and has a child and has children, and there's actually much more deeper, you know, rooted problems in corporate cultures that need to be addressed. There's a great analogy of a company that, you know, their women weren't coming back when they went on maternity leave, but nobody thought to ask them why. So there was this assumption made that they didn't want to come back because they wanted to stay at home and have children. So they were interviewed, and it turned out that none of them wanted to come back because they didn't want to come back to the toxic corporate culture that was the organisation. And I think those are much more deeper, difficult issues to address. I think there are some women who don't help other women. I think they just don't help anybody, but share experiences or
I did
how
have
we
one bad experience with them when I was I had a basically business angels tend to they're a bit like lemmings. They like to invest together in groups that they all invest in. There was one woman within this group, and she said, "So if we give you this £500,000, are you going to work full time?" And I said, "Well, I am working full time already." And she said, "Well, you're not. You know, you've got two kids." And I was like, "I can't believe you've said that. Of all the people in the room, you've said that to me." And it really did get me. But actually, things have really changed. My first fundraising round was in 2003. It's like 16 years ago. And now I just crowdfunded the Boot Claw in 30 days. You know, I didn't have to go through that long process. It's so much easier to raise funds now as women, because there's all these different innovative crowdfunding and fundraising platforms that aren't the whole VC route. And you can just do it so quickly and with so much less risk. So I think that's a really good sign of the times, that it is easier for women, particularly as we do so well in crowdfunding, if that's a funding route that we want to go down, because we're more realistic and we use more emotion in the message, and that actually appeals to crowds, not just high net worth individuals.
Yeah, I mean, do you have friends that you feel, or I know female colleagues that you feel aren't helping other women, or is it more we should just be calling this out? Like, what's the solution to this? Because you can't. It's a difficult conversation to have, and I think it's a brilliant question. A brilliant point.
Well, I think the worry is that we should all be doing more. This is not just one generational thing. It's turning a tanker.
Yeah.
And an example I give is that I was in an organisation, charitable organisation, where I realised the constitution only allowed men over 21 to vote. And women had no vote at all. I thought, this is ridiculous. We need to change this. And my allies were not other government lawyers of my age. There were actually 75-year-old women who had been giving into a charitable organisation for years and years and years, and were as outraged as I was. But they just hadn't had somebody to stand up and say, follow and let's do this.
Yeah.
And then we brought on the much younger people, and then we showed, if you bring women into an organisation at 18 and they are paying to part of an organisation, it's an income stream. Then the men listen.
Yeah, but I think this can't be about women fixing everything. And, you know, we have to bring men along, and they are such agents of change as well. I'm very conscious of time. It's 10 to 8.
Wow.
People obviously want nibbles and champagne as well. And I knew we'd run out of time. There's so much to cover. There's a question here, and then...
Sorry, I can't see anyone.
Sure.
Firstly, all amazing. So really inspiring. When they were interviewed for money to start this, they were asked what their husbands do.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how much is about our responses in terms of equality, because, for instance, my husband's been in meetings where they've asked what I do. You know, so how much is it a woman's responsibility not to react, in your opinion, and how much are we being oversensitive in certain regards?
I think that's a good point. I think in this instance, it wasn't one of those general chit-chat, nice conversations. It was quite pointed, and I think it actually bridges to your question as well, that it's I think we're on a cusp, and I please take this the right way, but I think previous generation, it was damn harder for you. My mum looks at me and goes, it's amazing what you've achieved. I'm like, it's a generation later. The opportunity for me is here to grasp. Yeah. The opportunity is totally here for us all now. We've got places like Albright. We've got support networks. We can do this now. So I think some of it is sensitivity. I think naturally, you know, that's human nature. And I think some of it, particularly in the area of fundraising, exists. That's a major problem. But I think the core point is we are, you know, the people of your generation. Sorry, I keep trying to find you through there. I think it's phenomenal what you've achieved in your career because it was damn harder than it is for us.
Oh, God,
yeah. I don't want it for my kids and my 9-year-old daughter to, you know, I don't want to be having this conversation. This is in our hands, and it's how we choose to act. And I'm asked to join loads of women in PR networks, etc. I don't join any of them. I've joined Albright as a community because I can't bear to sit around just chit-chatting about, you know, all the issues that exist. That's why I like, you know, the notion of tonight. It's here. This is our time. This is our opportunity. We now can do pretty much what we want. So if we don't do that, that's kind of on us.
And it's interesting, my membership is diverse in terms of age, and it's actually been a lot of the older women in my industry that have come to my events and said to me, you know, I didn't understand the value of networking, and this has been a brilliant platform, and I really wish someone had told me when I was 25 years old, because I've come to networking late and I find the ability in what you're doing, you know, it would have helped me so much in my career.
Yeah.
And I'm a real proponent of, I know there's a lot of concerns about women-only networks, but actually there's so much around social capital research that says that they can be really effective. But actually just the ability to have a platform to network, because we're told to network, but no one tells you how to do it or where to go.
And by the way, to clarify, it's not...
No,
it's not
general.
Networks that
I
I've
get
got...
get criticised because it's...
Yeah, it's not
it's
networks
women's
and
network.
Women's networks I have a problem with. It's when they're designed purely as a vehicle to voice,
to talk
complaint
about problems,
as opposed to
I agree. Yeah.
Like yours is very much
solutions driven. Yeah,
solutions driven. That's the key difference.
Yeah,
to me.
No, absolutely.
I'm not getting on with my microphone at all.
It's 5 to 8, so I think. Oh, there's another. We'll be here at 10 o'clock.
However, the way questions are framed, there is a promotional way and a prevention way. So promotional is, okay, if you're a man, you're asked promotional questions, for example, so the vision, the strategy, the growth, and that is directed at men predominantly, and women are asked prevention, so the risk aversion hypothesis is actually underlying the questions. So how are you going to overcome this barrier, or what do you think about the competition? So that's kind of, by definition, both men and women are studying a promotional way to men and a prevention way to women. And that is 100% correlated with the success of fundraising. Then, how you answer, most women will then say, well, I would counter or mitigate that risk by da-da-da, so you're then enforcing that prevention language. And men will say, well, we're going to grow the market, or we're going to overtake that by, and then promotion. And that is then suggesting that they will be more successful. The tip, if you do want to end up successfully fundraising, is that if you flip that, if you're asking a prevention way but then answering a promotional way, there is 14x more chances of you actually securing the funding. So you take a question about the risk and you say, well, you know, I see that it is an opportunity to grow whatever it is.
So do what politicians do and answer the question you want to be.
And that's
let's not talk about politics.
That's take a constraint and turn it into an opportunity. It's kind of what I was saying earlier, but in
turn
different.
It around.
It's,
so
yeah.
It's not in your mind, it actually happens, but there is. But it's not about how you preach, it's about how we ask.
Yeah. Sophie, a quick comment on imposter syndrome, and then we'll bring it to a close. Could you want to?
Well, it's going back to this belief of, you know, being bold or brave or anything. And I think imposter syndrome is something that does affect an enormous amount of people. It definitely affected me in my first, in my jobs. And I remember when I was feeling very, finding it very difficult, and I was speaking to my father, and I said, oh, you know, I just people keep asking me questions, and I don't even think I know the answers, and God, what if I get it wrong, and I don't even know how I got this job, I don't even know what I'm doing here. And he had a very successful career in the city as a stockbroker for years and years and years. And he said to me, he said, Sophie, I didn't think I knew what I was doing the whole time with all this money, and da-da-da. And he said, you know, I used to panic about it, and he said it's just it affects everyone. Yeah, I think
it's not just a female thing. No. I have a twin brother, and it's been fascinating to have. He's a CEO of a company owned by private equity, and it's been fascinating to have someone of the opposite sex throughout your entire life. We did pretty much the same GCSEs, A levels, and degree, completely different careers. And I don't think some of them are. Gender differences, but I think some of them are just personality. And we shouldn't lump men and women as homogenous groups that do all the same thing as well. So much that we didn't even get to cover, but I knew this would be the challenge. I hope you've enjoyed this. I think this has been a fascinating conversation, just really the tip of the iceberg of some of these really big systemic issues that we're all trying to solve. I've learned a lot about innovation and meeting you three as well. And thank you again to Charles Russell Speechleys and to Megan and the team here that have arranged this beautiful event. Thank you very much, and thank you for your questions. Thank you.
I don't mind going that way.
Yeah, that way.
So if you would like to stay and hang around and talk to each other, obviously, and talk to our wonderful panellists, then we've got more drinks and more nibbles on the first floor. There is a lift. It can fit about one and a half of you.
It really, that is true.
Thank you.
Thank you.